This is Fresh Air. Before you bite into a cheese enchilada or a turkey sandwich, do you ever stop to think about why you're eating what you're eating? My guest, Raymond Sokolov, can give you a cultural history of each ingredient of your dinner. He's just written a gastronomic history of how foods have followed immigration patterns around the world. Sokolov cites Columbus' trip to America as the moment that set off a culinary revolution that transformed the eating habits of the Western Hemisphere. It opened a door for the foods of the Native Americans and the Europeans to begin traveling back and forth across the Atlantic. Sokolov is the author of several cookbooks and writes about food for Natural History magazine. He feels that all this attention to food has left him with a set of taste buds more highly developed than the average eater.
I've been spending, by now, over 20 years, putting words on my taste sensations, which is something wine tasters are well known for doing. They have this funny vocabulary that people laugh at, but which they all know what they mean because they've agreed that when they have a little buzz at one corner of their tongue, they say it's violets. So it's very accurate for them. I have to do something for everybody, which is to say, be able to convey my taste sensations in meaningful language. So I think in that sense, I can put myself forward as an expert palate. I've been reviewing restaurants in national publications since 1971, and I've eaten pretty much everything that a person might be called on to eat in this world.
What are some of the things that you've eaten that you've even surprised yourself at your courage?
Raw deer heart, which a chef gave me in a restaurant. He had shot the animal quite legally during hunting season in New York, and in his culture, which was lower middle class French, rural, this was the best cut in the animal. Liver. It was the you take the purple quivering liver and just tie into it. And there were a lot of people watching when he brought it out. It was clear that that there was no turning back. And it had, how shall I say, an interesting and very profound taste and an alarming crunch.
Was this a test for your palate?
Well, I don't think he meant it that way. I really think he meant it seriously as a favor, because he really loved it. I think that it was actually quite good in the end, but it was very alarming. I've eaten insects and pond scum and a variety of things that people would call vermin or trash that people in other parts of the world are quite seriously happy to eat. I still have not had the legendary live insect taco in Mexico, but where the bugs crawl out of it unless you're very agile. I've been all over the place.
Do you have to prepare yourself mentally before you're going to eat something like a raw deer liver or some other food that perhaps your mother didn't prepare for you when you were a child? Do you have to prepare yourself for a meal like that?
No. In fact, you can't, because you could think about it and feel fear and loathing, I suppose, or try to suppress those feelings. But the interesting thing is to taste something, in effect, blindfolded and see whether you can make sense out of it given your past experience. So preparing is really, I think, the wrong way to do it. And, I mean, anybody can try this really with things that are quite common that we eat. If you don't know what it is and you put it in your mouth, and then try to identify what it is from the various sensations that you can get without your eyes.
Why do you credit Christopher Columbus with creating a gastronomic revolution?
Well, he's the symbol of what happened after 1492, and very rapidly after 1492. He, by discovering the Americas, which he did in the Caribbean, it's very important to remember, two hemispheres were merged, and foods almost immediately, which had existed in either one half of the world or the other, the New World or the Old World, began flowing back and forth, and the potato, the tomato, the green bean, all of those things went to Europe. And here in the New World, especially in Mexico, where there had been basically no livestock and therefore no dairy products, things came from Spain, because the Spanish Empire, which established itself there in Mexico in 1519 with Cortes, the settlers who came after him wanted to recreate the agricultural and gastronomic conditions that they knew from Spain. So they started growing things and raising livestock, which didn't exist there. Now, very rapidly, almost in the first generation of settlement from Europe, the Mexican food ideas, the pre-Columbian ones, got mixed up with the new ingredients, so that all of a sudden you had a taco filled with meat, or you had cheese made in Mexico. Before that, they didn't have anything like that. So a completely new world was invented in Mexico. Similar things happen in Europe.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Raymond Sokolov. He writes about food for Natural History magazine and is an editor at the Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Why We Eat What We Eat. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Raymond Sokolov is my guest. Well, when you're tracing food and you're watching where foods take root, how do you take into effect history and culture and politics, demographics, geography? How is there a way to see how that kind of mixes so that the tomato, for instance, or the potato, then gets eaten by particular people?
Well, what makes this interesting and possible is that we have a pretty good record of what people were eating at different times. So I was able to look at cookbooks and other kinds of sources for before 1492 or before 1500, and many people have done this, and you see people in Europe eating things which bear virtually no resemblance to anything that they eat now in countries that are now called France and Italy and Germany and so forth, some of which really didn't exist as countries back then. So you can see what happened before, and then you see what came afterwards, and we know from all kinds of testimony what didn't exist in Europe and what didn't exist in the New World, and then you see how these things get mixed together because you can go to those places now. And I did systematically go to all of the major centers of settlement for the Spanish Empire in the 16th century to see what had fallen out from the historical process in those places. Now, you know, it wasn't a great mystery, but I thought that I could take the palette we were talking about just before, all of this, you know, body of experience in tasting, and sort of put myself through the experience of eating those foods on the ground in Puerto Rico, which was a very, very early settled place, in Mexico, in Cartagena, Colombia, which was the sort of warehouse for the empire, and then I went to their Asian outpost in the Philippines, which was ruled from Mexico, and to see how the mixing of cultures had produced something new.
Well, you contrast Puerto Rico and the Philippines. You say that the Puerto Rico has truly Puerto Rican food, and the Philippines is a real mix. It's full of mixtures and borrowings from Spanish and Chinese and or Asian and other cultures as well. Is that the two opposite ends of the spectrum?
Well, what I like to say is that each of those places got a cuisine that reflects the pattern of settlement in the beginning. So Puerto Rico was a crossroads. There were boats coming from hither and yon. People would stop over. It got settled very early. So it was possible to bring in people from Africa, from Europe, and products from really the whole planet. In the Philippines, on the other hand, you had an extremely large resident Asian population. So it was a pure colonial situation with a very small kind of pinhead of European overlord society, and a vast number of Asians with a historic cuisine that they continued to eat. Now, what I found is that now there is a revival of nationalism there, as you were seeing with their rejection of our bases. But through food in restaurants now, they have, in recent years anyway, they have suddenly begun having true Filipino restaurants.
Would you say, and this is getting us into the 20th century, is there something very distinctly American about the American diet? How would you describe, then, American cuisine?
Well, American cuisine is this extremely complicated business of foods re-imported. I mean, the turkey that we celebrate on Thanksgiving, for example, is really, I mean, may have been the wild turkey at the first Thanksgiving, but the one we eat now is a bird that was not hybridized in this country from the wild turkey. It was a turkey that descends from Mexican turkeys that were sent to Europe and the Middle East in the 16th century and which were raised in European conditions and then re-exported to New England, the things we eat now are not direct examples of the ancestral Mexican bird, the guajolote, which the conquistadores saw and first described. So that would be one example. Then there are all these corn dishes which developed all up and down the East Coast, other ones which survive from kind of early Hispanic settlement in the Southwest. I mean, there's an immense and rich vocabulary of things, and it depends on which region you're in. The folkloric American dishes, the things which really weren't brought from somewhere else and which evolved spontaneously after colonization began, those are, separate for each region, and there's a lot of, by now, traveling back and forth. So we have Tex-Mex restaurants in, every part of the country. So it's hard to talk about true regionalism anymore. Nobody is naive, even the Hopis, the most isolated Aboriginal Americans with the best preserved life or culture from before contact with Europeans, have a vocabulary of dishes, but none of them are naive about them. It isn't, you couldn't find, I think, a Hopi who had never eaten a hamburger. So you've got a very complicated thing where they're self-consciously eating Hopi dishes like blue cornmeal balls called blue marbles, which they do to preserve their tradition. And only the traditionalists among them do that, but they all buy food in supermarkets on the reservation. So it's impossible, really, to generalize about U.S. food.
Well, would you say that we are in a post-Nouvelle Cuisine era?
Something like that. I mean, I think that for me, I mean, I just use the term Nouvelle Cuisine to describe a kind of the second great revolution in merging cuisines of the world and ingredients that after Columbus. I mean, you had this hundreds of years for these for ingredients that could move slowly by boat between the New World and the Old World to create these new cuisines with mixtures. Then, with air travel and far-flung tourism, people got really interested in exotic tastes, and that's what I think the Nouvelle Cuisine has really done, is to mix things up and put the kiwi or the avocado into traditional European cooking, things like that.
It's interesting to me when we talk about food and cultures that we use our mouths oftentimes to discover new cultures, whether it's through language and even using words and using food as a way to discover something outside of ourselves.
That's very true, I think, and it's logical that it would be that way. If you go to an unfamiliar place where you don't speak the language, then your only real direct physical deep contact with the culture could be through nonverbal things like food. You could go see dance performances, you could see buildings and architecture, scenery, you could walk around, you could meet people who were bilingual, but food is one of the basic ways of getting into a culture when you really don't know very much about it. We have Korean restaurants here now in great profusion, and I don't know any Korean, and many of the menus are simply written in Korean and not translated, and nobody can really explain to me what I'm getting. And yeah. So I order by pointing, but I'm certainly learning something about Korean culture in the process.
Do you have a memorable meal?
Of my whole life?
Yes.
It's always, the last one that I liked. I remember eating a tomato on a railroad siding in Greece in 1960, when I was a student, and I'd been on a very long train ride standing up from Paris through Yugoslavia. And there, I'd not been able to get any food. Water was a problem. It's been thoroughly unpleasant and hot. And it was my first introduction to what you could call a really depressing, poor peasant country. And we finally got out, and I was feeling very low about the poor Yugoslavs and myself, too, because I was very hungry and exhausted. And there, suddenly, the sun came out, and I was standing in Greece, and this man came by and sold me a beautiful tomato in August. And I ate it, and it dripped all over me, and I was very happy. And I thought about tomatoes in a way that I never had before, and that really returns me to my original point about eating things out of context or when you are really going to be surprised by them and you value them in a special way.
Raymond Sokolov, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Raymond Sokolov's book is called Why We Eat What We Eat. This is Fresh Air.